This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, inspiring characters, and most engaging brains in sport. In episode one, I chatted to the recently crowned Tour de France champion, Geraint Thomas, about how his life has changed since winning the biggest prize in cycling, the obsessive character that helped fuel his motivation and drive, and how he's still plagued by Olympic disappointment in spite of his two gold medals. Well, at this year's Tour de France, despite winning two stages of the race and wearing the leader's yellow jersey, the Welshman's chances of winning the race were still being written off by some who expected his infamous bad luck to strike again. Even on his own team, it seems only his long-term coach, Rod Ellingworth, truly believed he could win over teammate and multiple Tour champion Chris Froome, with many expecting Thomas to take a tumble. His perceived bad luck is something he addresses in his new book, and it's something I asked him about to start part two of When Orla Met Geraint Thomas. To go back to the book again, I noticed that you said a few times, I'm not cursed, I don't feel cursed, I'm not cursed when it comes to crashing, and the fact that you repeated it a few times, it stood out. But you must have thought at one stage, I mean, if we look at just some of your crashes from 2013, at the Tour de France when you smashed your pelvis and still managed to ride for the whole 3 weeks and finish in Paris, or years before that when you ruptured your spleen on the way to the velodrome on a trip to Australia, so it wasn't even in race action, falling at the prologue of the Dauphiné this year, I mean, and many more in between, you say 2016, 2017 as well. Was there never a stage where you doubted yourself and thought, okay, all this talent and all this achievement so far is wonderful, but I'm always just plagued by something. There's just something.
Honestly, no. I think it just maybe that's the confidence that I say I don't really have when it comes to like having that. But I just didn't think I was cursed or anything. I was just like, it's just bad luck and I'm gonna get what I deserve in the end. Just keep doing the right thing and keep pushing as hard as you can and keep putting yourself in the right place and it'll happen. And don't be scared to fail. Like, don't sort of start thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll just sit back here and you know, come third or fourth and not have a mishap and miss out on, you know, winning or having that disappointment. But yeah, maybe I didn't even realise I mentioned it a few times, actually. But maybe that's sort of like my way of sort of like convincing myself as well. Like, just believing it and just saying it to yourself all the time, yeah, as a way of coping with that.
Does having that element of either wanting to or feeling a need to prove people wrong, does that motivate you as well?
Yeah, that does. Yeah, especially when people are saying, oh, what's he concentrating on the like stage races for and Grand Tours? He should do the classics and this and that. And,
like, so you say you don't listen, but you do, really.
Yeah, because like I don't go looking for it, but when I'm hear about it or stumble across it, then it does irritate me, and I don't like to admit it, but it does. And yeah, the part of me is just like, oh, all right, then I'll prove you wrong now. And it's, I've always sort of had that, really. Like, even when if Rod on the academy, like, he knew how to sort of like push my buttons sometimes and like, you know, tell you how it was, and you'd be like, right, okay, yeah, I'll prove him wrong next time. And I think, yeah, that's always been in me as well. And yeah, even when it's like random people that, you know, just fans, and they just, everyone has an opinion, it's fine. And but it's still like, all right, okay, then I'll show you. It's not like I stay up at night like thinking about them all night, but yeah, certainly like, oh, okay, then, yeah, we'll see.
You mentioned Rod Ellingworth, who's been your coach since you were a kid, really, and took you through the GB Academy and now a coach at Sky. And I was with him in the car as you were going up Alpe d'Huez, so that was your second stage win at this year's tour. And I'm just thinking in terms of proving people wrong, because it felt to me, certainly in hindsight and reading your book, like you also had to prove some of your team wrong. But with Rod in the car that day, when you crossed the line, he just said, bloody hell, he can win this now.
Yeah.
And I was quite surprised by that, because the whole narrative on the team was still, we're still behind Chris. You know, Chris Froome is our leader. And it felt like he was the one that believed all the way through, actually, that this was going to be your year to win the Tour.
Jeez, we're on the stage again.
Well done, G. Jesus Christ, that's some win up here for G. Flipping Al Duez, isn't it? Eh? My lord. A young kid, yeah. Racing around in his Cardiff jersey. Yeah, unbelievable, really, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty special, isn't it, bloody hell. Good old G, flipping oath. Hey, this is serious now.
How long can he keep yellow for, then?
The whole race now, eh? Why not? Couldn't he? There's no reason why he couldn't.
Yeah, I think... I heard that as well. Somebody played that to me, his reaction, which was funny. Rod's a bit like me in a way that he just says what he thinks, really, and he doesn't sort of try to hide anything. And I obviously know him really well, and then having him in the team was like there through the whole thing as well was amazing. And I think he's known me since I was 18, and he believed in me. And last year, actually, at the tour, he said, I'm not going to retire until you win the tour, G. So this
he's
year,
got a crisis in his hand,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I haven't actually given him... I've got a jersey for him and I've written on it saying, cheers, Rod, you can retire. But, I think the team did. Most of the team did. But I don't know for sure because I didn't ask him. But a little bit of it was like, all right, okay, and yeah, I'll prove to everyone now that I won't sort of just fall away and I will be able to... finish it off. But then having the support of people like Rod as well, who were so behind me, certainly helped a lot as well.
Because you've been so open since the tour, and I love reading all the stories after a race is finished when you get a totally different perspective on what happened over the three weeks. But you've been so open about different incidents, like where during the or before the team time trial, when team management said, right, if Froome has a mechanical or a puncture, we all wait. We don't stop for anyone else. And you were second on GC at that stage, were you?
Yeah.
Or when you were still second and your lead over Chris had increased and you were all desperate for aircon one night and Chris was the only rider who was allowed aircon and you snuck the aircon into your room and whacked it on anyway. But right up until, midway through that last week, it still felt like while they were, in theory, backing you, certainly making the right noises in public, in private it was very different.
Yeah, I think that was the main thing with the book as well. I wanted to just be completely honest and say how it was and exactly what happened. I don't like hold it against them in any way. Like Froome had won 6 Grand Tours, and they certainly, after my 2 stage wins, they were riding for both of us, really. There was no real favourites because the way we wanted to ride was the way we both wanted anyway. I think it would have been different if I was second and Froome was third and he was more of a punchier, pure climber and I was like a big sort of diesel and couldn't climb quite as quick. But what worked for me worked for him, so it kind of we were lucky in that respect. But yeah, when it came to the team time trial thing, it was a big deal, like especially at the time. And so I thought I had to put it in and say exactly how it was.
Because it was the first time that reality was spelt out, really, wasn't it? Because all the way into the tour and at the start of the tour, it was, you're protected rider, co-leader, whatever that might mean. But then the reality of it was very different. I mean, that's the complete opposite to being a protected rider, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was more, I don't know, vice president rather than co-leader, yeah. Or backup or whatever you want to call it. But that was when I was like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe. I didn't expect to ever be on like an equal footing, but I thought they'd at least, I was like, oh, you know. Because the way I saw it was if I punched after 2K, okay, they reckon they'd lose around 30 seconds if they waited for me. But by waiting for me, would I then give the team an extra 10 seconds back? So would we just lose 20 seconds? And then by not waiting for me, would they lose more? It's hard. How do you make that call anyway? And I knew they would have been up all night like discussing it, and so I said my bit, and then they still stuck to what the plan was, so I was like, okay, yeah, fair enough. And just the chances of that happening were so small anyway, but it was one of those I was like, right, I can either be all emotional again and get wound up and take this with me over the next 3 weeks, or put it to one side and just crack on, remember what I got to do, just think about the process and everything, and prove them wrong in the end. And yeah, that's what happened.
Because there were plenty of chances for the emotion to override the logic. I mean, there were two other stages where Chris was very open. Well, one in particular where he was very open about wanting to attack.
Mm.
And then another stage towards the end, I think it was maybe the Wednesday, the Thursday of the last week, where he wasn't so open about it, but you got the feeling that he wanted to attack again. And that, you know, in the book, you're very sanguine about it and saying, well, you know, he's 4 times tour champion. He's won a Grand Tour 6 times. Of course, he's going to want to win, but he wants to win over you, you know, that. I mean, you can't really not take that personally in a way, I guess. Do you think if you'd allowed those emotions to overtake you, you still could have gone on to win? Do you think that it was fundamental to your win that you were able to switch that off slightly?
Yeah, I think so. And definitely. I think if it was maybe 4 years ago, I might not have had the same sort of approach. I might have just, cracked a bit and got all het up and annoyed. And I guess it's going back to that confidence. Like, I was confident that I could match through me. And like, if I was just going to look at him as a pure rival, he was a rival that I knew what he wanted to do and how he wanted to attack and what I knew I'd be able to match him. But I didn't even see him as a rival either, in a weird way. Even though he did want to attack to win and I was the leader, I just saw it as a benefit to me in a way. It made, you know, Roglic or Dumoulin, you know, ride earlier and put them in the red a bit more. And so, more or less, just spun it in my head to think, well, it's still good for me. And I think just the way I was going and the way I was feeling it, that certainly helped. I think if I was feeling a bit vulnerable and a bit weak, or as if I was starting to tail off, then it might have played more on my mind. But I was kind of like, oh yeah, no, it's fine. He can do what he wants and try to go. And then, and then if it did come down to a stage where it was just me against him, then I was confident I would have had the legs to do something about it.
Do you think you make each other better riders? I mean, I'm thinking of the incident in Tenerife earlier this year where you say that brutal weather and you and Wout Poels went out and did your training session as you should have done. Chris decided to stay in the stationary bike for an hour. Saw you guys coming back dripping wet. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's what I should have done. So we did then. So he did go out and do his training after all. Do you think you push each other on in a way?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the key thing with the whole team, I think, while we're so strong in the tour, is that everyone wants to be in that tour team and everyone is pushing each other day after day in training. And we have our Tenerife camps where, you know, the majority of the tour team is at, or even more. And it's that day after day, everyone's pushing, everyone wants to be a part of it, whether that's, you know, the mid-mountain guys or even, you know, the guys like Luke. And you know, there's always competition for those places and it's the pinnacle of our season and everything is built towards that. And yeah, it goes from like Luke and, you know, Stannard and Nisi and yeah, all those guys. I'm definitely forgetting someone now.
It's all right, it's been a long couple of months.
And then, you know, it goes all the way to like the top then with me and Froome. And it's not like, it is competitive and it is sort of like pushing each other and because you want to sort of, well, be better than each other really, but it's in a, it's not aggressive or anything. It's not like if you're doing it with Dumoulin or like any of the other rivals, you kind of, my mum always says hate's a strong word, but you want to really dislike them, don't you? Just because they're your rivals. So
I love that level of your upbringing, by the way. She's not even here. She probably won't listen to this podcast, but you're still avoiding the word just because that's what your mum told you.
Yeah, yeah. But
you really want to say hate.
Yeah. Well, no, it is true though. It is a strong word. You know, I don't hate them, but I do really dislike them. But I don't even really dislike them. But when it comes to your training, and you know what I mean, that really drives you more on to be better. So it's not that level with Froome, but it's just that competitive sort of always trying to go head to head with each other.
And yet, that respect between the two of you feels genuine, and I don't just mean from reading stories. I've seen it up close. I've seen it with you too. I saw it in Paris. He seemed genuinely happy for you to have won, and of course the respect that you have for him shines through. It's quite something. I mean, that's very unusual.
Yeah, and I think we've known each other for so long as well, and we're just genuinely good mates. And I think the main thing that made it good was he did exactly everything he wanted to do. You know, there was no, you're not allowed to do this or that. You need to do something for G now. And I think he just knew that deep down he just didn't have the legs to win. And that was probably what helped the most of it all, really. Like, if he was told, no, you can't do that, but he felt that he could, then it might have been different.
And I guess that harked back to the tour of 2012 when Sir Bradley Wiggins won and Chris was told to haul back, I guess, and to work for Brad. And the whole question after that was, well, could Chris Froome have won the Tour de France if he'd been allowed to, at least with this tour? That was all put to bed. There was no question whatsoever. You were the strongest rider in the tour.
Yeah, and I think that certainly helped our relationship, really. And maybe, looking back now, I haven't just thought of this now, but this is like a psychology thing, isn't it? But maybe that's what the team knew all along. Maybe that was like Dave's big sort of master plan, just let Froome do what he wants and that'll be the best thing for the atmosphere and the team of things. I don't know, but...
It's only beautiful when it works out, eh?
Exactly, yeah.
I know we're running out of time, but I want to ask you about next year, just quickly. You said that you don't know, having now achieved the very best that there is to achieve in cycling, you feel motivated right now and you want to get back into routine and, I guess, back into your comfort zone, which is a discomfort zone for everybody else. But could you go and do it again? Could you go through all of it again and the sacrifices and the emotional strain and just manoeuvring every single bit of the booing fans and the questions from the journalists and the internal politics in the team and have the motivation to do it all over again?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly at the moment, I'd say yes. Like, I think I can do the training. Yeah, a piece of piss is easy. Well, not a piece of piss. But I can get out there and do it and do the hard yards because I kind of, like I say, I have that. I like doing that anyway. The diet is the hardest, I think, overall, of everything, even with when it comes to the questions. And that's probably the most annoying is because I thought writing about everything and just putting it out there, I thought that would be it. Like, oh, yeah, I've said what it was and said what I thought. It's just made even more questions now about Froome, and that's sort of like the main thing that I've realised this week is that everyone wants to know more about that, and it's kind of like, yeah, that's probably the one thing I'm like, oh, maybe I'm going to have to brace myself for a lot of them over the next sort of year, especially leading up to the tour.
But, does that matter? I mean, that was always going to happen. You've got two tour winners on the same team.
Yeah, but it just like, when you have to talk about it day after day, it gets tiresome then. But maybe I can just send everyone to this podcast.
Do it.
But so yeah, I think I can go back. And, certainly get to that level again. But every year is different. You don't know, like, maybe Dumoulin will improve more than me and Froome and or Roglic or anyone, really. So you never know. But I think I can get back to that level. It just depends. Like I say, it's not just on me. It's on what everybody else does as well.
Like whenever I first met you, 2009... You just won, you won the year before your Olympic gold medal, and I was in Tuscany to film and interview a few of you guys who were announced as the first riders for Team Sky. And I remember following you all up a mountain to do some filming, and then we stopped at one stage, and my producer at the time, Leah Hervey, said, hey guys, we get take a picture, and you can look back on this when you're all famous. And you piped up with, I'm famous already.
I don't remember that.
It's my first memory of you, and I thought, oh yeah, that guy's confident.
I did actually see that picture the other day.
With Steve Cummings, Brent Swift.
Yeah, on our Vespas as well, I think. Yeah. But I was a bit chunky then. Well, I am now. But it is strange, but it's come a long way for sure.
I just want to finish off by asking you about, there's a little anecdote in the book of you winning, I think, the first stage of the youth tour of Manchester as an 11-year-old kid. Yeah. And it came with a yellow jersey, am I right, in remembering?
Yeah.
And it was on at the same time as the Tour de France. And you said, in the book anyway, that you thought when you got that yellow jersey, wow, this must be what it's like to win the Tour de France. Yeah. Was it? Does it compare in any way to your childhood dreams?
It does in a way, because it's when you're in it, that's the be-all and end-all. Like, Manchester Youth Tour was like the pinnacle. That was like everything. And then, yeah, as a 12-year-old anyway, and then it means so much to you at the time. And then you look back and you're like, you know, like, but, and then now it was the same thing, you know, it's the biggest sort of, well, the pinnacle of the sport, like completed cycling in July. But yeah, it's just it was similar feelings, yeah, because especially when you're 12 as well, it's like, it's just like, yeah, your whole world's a bit different, isn't it? So yeah, I still probably wouldn't have believed anyone though, even if they told me, oh, 2012, that I was gonna do the same as Brad and win the tour, I don't think I would have believed him then.
Well, he may have completed cycling, but it truly doesn't seem to have changed Geraint Thomas much. In fact, age, experience and success have probably made him even more humble than that ever so slightly cocky kid I met back in 2009. We mentioned both Dr. Steve Peters and Rod Ellingworth as important figures in Thomas's success, and I have chats with both of them coming up in this series of When Orla Met, so watch out for those. But first,
it's always important to have a diverse array of storytellers, because you've got so many different people from different backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, different class backgrounds. I always think it's important to have more than one type of perspective on anything. And in particular in sports, if you want stories to be told in a different way and focusing on stuff that normally wouldn't be picked up by kind of men. And I can sit in front of any journalist and talk about stuff, but ultimately they choose what to write down, and what's written down is what's made permanent. Bringing more female journalists into that sphere, I think that you'll just get lots and lots of different perspectives on that.
That's coming up in When Orla Met Dina Asher-Smith, a chat with one of the breakout sports stars of the year just gone, combining huge success in athletics with appearances in Vogue magazine, on the catwalk of Paris Fashion Week, and several awards as Sports Personality and Sportswoman of the Year. A huge thanks to Jonathan Rowe for expertly editing this episode of When Orla Met. Don't forget to give me a follow on Instagram or Twitter, or to email me with any feedback or interview ideas, orla@whenorlamet.com. And if you'd like to leave me a review on iTunes, please do if it's good. And you can subscribe to the podcast for free on your usual platforms to make sure you don't miss out on any of the chats still to come on When Orla Met.